Well, good evening and welcome to another 2 hours of Jewish soul music. I'm your host, Charlie Bernhout. Each week I try to bring you some of the best in the cantorial and Yiddish and Israeli, Hasidic, whatever, wonderful Jewish music. It's good to be back with you and hope you enjoyed the interview last week. And I want to thank Yisachar Miron for allowing me to keep my theme song of Tzeina Tzeina. It's really one of my favorite songs, in case you weren't aware. First let me tell you that later on this first hour, we'll be hearing from Rabbi Stephen Przanski of Congregation B'nai Yeshurun in Teaneck, an old friend and one of the few rabbis who stands up for the truth, to say the least. Okay, if you were listening last week, you know that I was very sad to report the fact that my dear friend Herb Zweibahn, the chairman of Americans for Safe Israel, passed away. It was actually last Wednesday night, a week ago Wednesday, and he was buried a week ago Friday. And as you know, I've been on the board of Americans for Safe Israel for 15 years. It's probably one of the only true organizations that speaks the truth about what's happening in Israel. A wonderful Zionist organization. Really one of the few, if the only one, perhaps, that stayed true to its principles and refused to give in to the left. And Herb Zweibahn was just a wonderful man, a giant, really, and he will be sorely missed. I want to dedicate a couple of songs to his memory, because music does have a way of expressing some wonderful thoughts. The first one dedicated to the memory of Herb Zweibahn will be Jan Pierce singing as Brent. And you know, if you've been listening to my program over the years, that for Yom HaShoah every year, I play this wonderful version by Jan Pierce. There's a lot of versions of Unser Shtetl Brent, or as Brent. And essentially, it's foretelling the coming of the Holocaust. It was written by Mordechai Gebertig in, I believe, 1939. And he just said that the poor town is burning and everything is being destroyed. And you stand by and look on with folded arms. You stand and look passively on while our town is burning. And in the end, he says, only you can save it. Extinguish the fire with your very blood if you must. And yet you stand by with flechte hand, with folded arms, while the village is burning. And this was certainly not the case with Herb Zweibahn. He did not stand by and watch Israel burning. He stood there with every ounce of his strength and fought for that brave country. So let's start with as Brent, Jan Pierce.
Es brennt, bei unser Arm Städteln aber brennt. Weise Winden mit Radosen reißen, brechen und zu blasen, starker noch die wilde Flammen, als herum schein brennt. Und ihr steht und kicht mit verlegte Hemd. Und ihr steht und kicht das Eisig, unser Städte sprennt. Es
der Lach es brennt. Es kann Cholile kommen der Moment. Das Ganze steht und mit uns zusammen soll er weg in Nacht in Flammen bleiben, wenn die noch erschlacht schwarze Puste brennt. Und ihr steht und kifft das Eisig mit verlegte Hand. Und ihr steht und kifft das Eisig, unser Städtels brennt.
Wow, powerful. Don't stand by with folded arms while Israel is being destroyed and going up in flames. No, you can't. You really can't do that. Well, 1973, what is that, 38 years ago, wow. Moshe Stern, at a concert, sang a song called A Gazang to Yisrael. Let me see. I have. It was written by in Yiddish by Edith Hans, a song dedicated to Israel and Jerusalem. I think I'm going to give you the translation as we go along because the words are so powerful. But we'll get started, and then I'll give the translation. This is Moshe Stern, at the age of 37 or 38. He was born in 1935. Yeah, he was 38 years old in 1973 when he recorded this. A Gazang to Yisrael. Well, you know what? I'll give the translation before each section so that you'll understand. Israel, you are stronger than iron and you can demonstrate much heroism. Israel, we are proud of you with your victories and your strength without end.
Yisroel, Yisroel, bist starker von Eisen, als du kennst so viel Gewure beweisen. Yisroel, mir seiner Stolz mit dir, mit deinen Siegen, mit deinem Mut und Afir. Mir gucken mit Meire, wie greis die Sakone und dein Gefahr.
We look with fear how great the danger and your risk, with enemies, with bloody hate, who want to bring us pain and suffering.
Gegraben von Sonne mit blutiger Sinne, zu bringen uns weitig ohne Zahn.
But with spiritual heroism, with a firm hand, we will bring joy and peace to the land.
Nor mit geistiger Gewura, mit a fester Hand, weil mir bringen Frieden, schalen zu dem Land.
Young innocent blood flows. O heaven, note well how the army defends the holy land. Bring to the enemies defeat and shame.
Mit a fester Hand, weil mir bringen Frieden schollen zu dem Land. Es gießt sich das junge unschuldige Blut. O Himmlen, Himmlen, guckt sich zu gut. Zahl verteidigt das heilige Land. Bringt euch die Sonne ihm, Mapole und Scham.
Punish the enemy with their just deserts of defeat and shame. As a miracle, the new land came into being, thanks to Chalutzim, brave heroes, and Jews with spiritual thoughts.
Nor wie durch Anes is aufgekommen das nahe Land. A dank die Chalutzim, Giborim und Helden und Jiden mit göttlichen Gedank. Noch Jahre hunderter Bengschaft zu Erde von zu Jerusalem, die heilige Stadt.
After hundreds of years of yearning for the land of their fathers, for Jerusalem and the holy city.
Noch Jahre hunderte Bengschaft zu Erde von dir. Zu Jerusalem, die heilige Stadt.
That was Moshe Stern with a Gazang zu Yisrael. I guess I skipped a line two here or there, but you got the idea. Let's hear one more selection of Moshe Stern, another dedication to Herb Zweibein and the late great Zionist leader Herb Zweibein. This is Moshe Stern singing Exodus.
Kinene bihalom, lise kot lagur bistei shalom, et akarmel ere sagiv uhamare, kol hayam nosheik et anamne marom. El har Zion ashkith belev nirgash Gilboa et nafshi chavash Hanegev lefanai uksham chalom chayai Zot arzi uva ech yeshuv mechadash. So take my hand. with me and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong to make this land our home. If I must fight, I'll fight to make this land our own. Until I die, this land is mine.
Yes, certainly an appropriate selection gives the voice. This land is ours. This land is mine. It certainly was the belief of Herb Zweibahn, and he lived his life to the fullest in voicing that that ideal. He will be sorely missed, to say the least. Bensian Shanker next with Mizmor Le David.
Le David Hashem Roi Loi Echo Mi Yisrael Le David Hashem Roi Oy vey,
Wonderful, Bensian Schenker. Yes, he is one of my favorites. I admit that openly. Let's hear one more selection. Dror Yikra with Bensian Schenker.
Dror Yikra Bevenvein Indi Bein tzorchem kimoi vavas Niyim shimchem velom vavom yushpas Shirubu vinuchu veyoy Yesha, I'll say ye me, Nita soy reik, the soy carbi, Shiesha was bene yami, Droich pura, be soy botro, be game bovella, shebe gobro, the toy so rai, be yaf, be evero. Shema koili biyom v'vayim v'kro Elohim tein b'mi yitbor Hadas shiitah b'raish tidah Balam azir v'lah Anizo Shiloh Imiyim Tein B'meyena Adoich Komai Kei Lekano B'moy Gelevov Ovan B'gino B'nar Hivpe O'nemar Leno D'shoyneinu Lecharino Yei chachman linam v'shecho V'hii cheser v'roi y'shecho Nitzor mitzvas k'doi y'shecho Shemoyr shambos k'ot y'shecho
Bensian Schenker, Dror Yikra. Okay, let's go back to Ron Eli Ron. And this is Shedemati, My Field. It's a farmer's work song. Work song. Ruth Ben-Tzvi simulates on the jar drum the sound of the sickle cutting through the air. This is from an album, Ron Eli Ron, Golden Songs of Israel. And the album was produced by Art DeLugoff. That will date you somewhere around the late 60s, early 70s. Shedemati.
Sh שדמתיר אי משחר זרעתי בדמעה תפילת היוגב נשמע שדמתיר רבתת ללי משחרה באור חמה לפני קוצר שחה שחה כמה בצד רב חרמש כהלל יונה פלעול חרמש כהלל יונה 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 ותת ללי משחרה באור חמה לפני קוצר שחה שחה
Shedemati. That was Ronelli Ron. A couple of things. First of all, I got several emails telling me that the Mordechai Ben David selection that I played a couple of weeks ago was to the tune of Melody of Love by Bobby Vinton from the 70s. And Carl and others, thank you for keeping me straight on that. Okay, this coming Sunday evening at 7 o'clock at Young Israel Bethel of Borough Park, that's on 15th Avenue, you know, in Brooklyn, February 6th at 7 p.m. sharp. This is Hasidic and cantorial music, Sounds of Beautiful Voices. Our friend Cantor Ben-Sion Miller, together with Binyamin Helfgott, that's the brother of Ichemer, Cantor Sudik, that's Sudik Greenwald, and Cantor Tzvi Weiss. It's a wonderful lineup of cantors. If you haven't heard Binyamin Helfgott and Sudik and Tzvi Weiss, I recommend that this would be a good opportunity. So tickets are on sale at the door at Mostly Music, at Westside Judaica. And, Shimmy Miller will be... accompanying with his Aaron Miller Choir. So once again, that's this coming Sunday, the 6th of... this Sunday, the 6th? Yes, at 7 o'clock at Young Israel Bethel. Of course, don't forget, on the 20th at the Merkin Hall will be the debut of the cantorial trio. And you know I'm particularly fond of Yanky Lemmer, Zevi Muller, and Shimmy Miller. Cantor Danny Goldar will be at the piano. We had special arrangements written for the group by Israel Adelson, and it will be dynamite. This is a debut of three of the finest young cantors on the scene today, and I look forward to greeting you there. Many of you, I know, are ready to purchase the tickets. If you want to purchase them online, drop me an email, cbjmusic@aol.com, and I'll send you the link. CBJ Music, Charlie Bernhardt Jewish Music. So it's very simple, cbjmusic@aol.com. obviously you have a computer because you're listening to this on the computer, and you can select your own seat and pay through the internet. It's wonderful. You just click, on comes the seating chart. You put an X on the seats that you select, and you got the tickets. Okay, so a lot happening with Chazanis. Okay, let's go back to the early 70s. This will date some of you in the audience. This will be the Limelighters with Arava. It's this was at Carnegie Hall, the Limelighters.
Till the plain is in flower.
Okay, that will date you. I think if Jonathan, if you're listening, I know that dates you. You knew the Limelighters and all these other groups, and they were very good. Well, you know, a couple weeks ago, I announced the untimely death of Moshe Yes, of the Megama duo, and I want to play a couple more selections of his this week and perhaps next week. This is God is Alive and Well in Yerushalayim, the Megama or Megama duo.
If I ever get back to California, I'm gonna round up every Jew I've ever known. I'm gonna sit them right down there in front of me. I'm gonna take this guitar and sing them all this song. God is alive and well in Jerusalem. People praying three times a day to him. The cars, the bars, the stocks and bonds, unkept lawns, grab a boat, a plane, if need be, swim. Some folks got a Lincoln Continental with tinted glass so nobody sees in.
just one time I'd like to roll down their window and say you ain't gonna fool the Lord with this hunk of tin. God is alive and well in Jerusalem, yeah. People praying three times a day to him. Throw away the cars, the bars, the stocks and bonds, and upkept lawns. Grab a boat, a plane, if need be, swim. God is alive and well in Jerusalem, yeah. People praying three times a day to him. Throw away the cars, the bars, the stocks and bonds, and upkept lawns.
Yeah, God is alive and well in Jerusalem. Let's hear Give Me a Minion. That's coming up next. Megala.
Flying through the air with a cape may be great for Superman. And sitting on the Empire State is good for King Kong. Landing on the moon is out of this world for the astronauts. But speaking for myself, I know where I belong. Give me a minion, my tallest and thrilling and a yarmulke. And give me some matzo for pace, sucking candy, total wine. You know
Oh, wow. Give me a minion. Well, if you've heard me over the years, perhaps you've heard me say that one of the greatest proofs for the existence of God is that the Jewish people survive our rabbis. Of course, that doesn't go for a lot of the rabbis who we know, but perhaps you saw the ad, ads in the major papers the other day, rabbis with the Funds for Justice, Jewish Funds for Justice, a left-wing, lefty, radical left group of people, if there ever was one. And the full-page ad was calling for a censure of Glenn Beck by Murdoch. Why? Because Beck had the audacity to criticize George Soros. Those of you who know the history of George Soros, he's an embarrassment, well, an embarrassment is putting it mildly. The fact that this guy is a Jew is worse than an embarrassment. And it's so interesting that George Soros donated $250,000 during the last 2 years to the Jewish Fund for Justice. So who do you think paid for all those ads in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal? And these rabbis, or the, I should say these so-called rabbis, because any rabbi worth his salt would not sign on to such, when, first of all, wouldn't even belong to such an organization. I even question its loyalty to America, but leave that to the side. it's so interesting also that they always talk about freedom of speech, don't they? But if you disagree with them, then they call for your downfall. It's only if you agree with them and listen to them, then there's freedom of speech. Anyway, there is one rabbi in particular of whom I'm very fond, who speaks the truth, and I'm so proud and pleased to have a commentary from him. It's Rabbi Stephen Przanski of Congregation B'nai Yeshurun in Teaneck, New Jersey. Rabbi.
Charlie, good evening. Nice to be with you.
Well, there's a lot going on in the world, and of course, the probably one of the key concerns we have right now is Egypt.
Yes, it's amazing how quickly the situation changes on the ground. Who would have thought that 2 weeks ago there'd be Egyptian Americans in Astoria, Queens, of all places, calling for Mubarak's overthrow? Who even knew he had opponents living in Astoria, Queens, not to mention in the Cairo and the rest of Egypt?
Right, right.
But totalitarian countries are always built on a very unstable foundation. There is a veneer of stability, but there's tremendous turmoil underneath. It's almost like an earthquake. Everything is stable above ground, but underneath ground, it's very turbulent until the earth breaks apart. And that's what's happening in Egypt today.
Of course, our key concern is the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamists not only taking over in Egypt, but in all the countries where the dictators and the tyrants are either being overthrown or will be overthrown.
Right. It's almost natural that power is going to devolve upon the forces that are most organized, and unfortunately from Israel's perspective, that which has a the most coherent and evil philosophy. In life, in nature, and in politics, we abhor vacuums, and the vacuum is always filled by the group that has an ideology that can appeal to people. One of Mubarak's weak points, ironically enough, was that he had maintained the treaty with Israel. Dictators in the Arab Muslim world have always used Israel as a foil to rile up the native population to blame Israel for any shortcomings at home. Syria has lived off this for many years. Well, Mubarak did not have that luxury, couldn't blame what's happening in Egypt on Israel. And in fact, the Muslim Brotherhood, aside from the crackdown and secularization in Egypt, was disheartened by Egypt's closing of the border with Gaza to Palestinians. The world, the West, America, has always made much of the fact that the Gaza-Israel border is closed because of the terror emanating from Gaza. Less has been made of the fact that the Gaza-Egypt border has been closed even longer, and it's even less permeable because of the fact that Egypt does not want Gazans or Palestinian terror entering its country. But in fact, the Muslim Brotherhood has had very large and extensive tentacles, and they're responsible for many of the indigenous terror movements throughout the Middle East on some level, including Hamas, including Islamic Jihad, and in some sense, Hezbollah as well. And I don't doubt for a moment that there is an Iranian hand in what's going on in Egypt, especially in light of the WikiLeaks disclosures that revealed that Mubarak was one of the Arab leaders who was most concerned about nuclear weapons in Iran.
Uh-huh.
And so Iran is an enemy of Egypt. They're vying now for supremacy in the Arab and Muslim world. Mubarak has always been on somewhat of a shaky foundation, bolstered by the army. But when you look at the links between the Muslim Brotherhood and Iran and the mullahs and ayatollahs in Iran, then notwithstanding the Shia-Sunni differences, I have no doubt that Iran plays some role. By the way, this is also underscored by the curious participation in this of Mohammed al-Baradei, who's returned to Egypt now after many years, who won a Nobel Peace Prize for heading the International Atomic Energy Administration. you know, we shouldn't be so quick to bask in the glow of his Peace Prize. Keep in mind that Yasser Arafat won a Nobel Peace Prize as well. But one of the reasons why Abarde won the Peace Prize is because in his capacity as head of the IAEA, somehow he was unable to locate or detect any nuclear weapons preparations in Iran. So no doubt that he has ties to Iran and now to the Muslim Brotherhood, and he's being projected as the point man, as the go-to guy, so to speak, for liberalization and reform in Egypt. Hmm. What a mistake that is, but nonetheless, there is a vacuum, and it's liable that he fill it. You know, keep in mind that there are other revolutions. I think back to the Russian Revolution, not that I was alive then, but after the Tsar was overthrown, the Bolsheviks did not take over right away. It was the Mensheviks, the Kerensky government, that was in power for almost a half year, and they were more moderate than the communists. But they, too, were overthrown because they didn't have the might or the brutality of the communist army. So El Baradei is portrayed as a secularist, someone who's interested in reform. I don't believe it. The fact that the Muslim Brotherhood is supporting him itself does not bode well for the future. But nonetheless, he may himself, if he does take power, be just a transitional or a figurehead in Egyptian governments. And that story has not yet finished.
Well, it does seem that the army is going to be playing a key role as to where they decide to put their backing.
That's the way it is in every society in the Arab Middle East. If you control the army, you'll remain in power. Once you lose the army, then you've lost any power at all. Unfortunately, the Arab Middle East is not fertile territory for democracy. So even the cries from the streets that they want freedom, democracy, they understand it in a different context. One, they do not want to be tortured by the secret police, which is a universal good. We understand that, and we appreciate that. But it's not as if they're going to turn around tomorrow and vote for Ahmed Jefferson or Muhammad Madison. That's not going to happen. I've always felt that you know, I was greatly respectful and appreciative of President Bush. I felt this is the one point in which he erred. I remember sitting in a meeting with him in a small group in 2002, in September of 2002, and he was laying out his vision for the Middle East, and he had a freedom agenda and a democracy agenda, and he felt that it was possible that the Arab world would democratize, and certainly there was an American and an Israeli interest in the democratization of the Arab world. But I felt that at that point he was a fantasist. He was engaging in wishful thinking because, unfortunately, there is no democracy that's innate or endemic to the Middle East, and it's hard to imagine one developing. The people, even if they vote, we've had this experience already in Gaza as well as in Lebanon, if they're allowed to vote, they often vote for the most extreme element.
Right.
Meaning they use the processes of democracy in order to vote for an even more brutal dictator.
Yes.
Now, Mubarak has been brutal in his own way, but if they think a Muslim Brotherhood strongman is going to be less brutal, then they're in for a rude awakening. But by that point, the army and the Islamic forces there may be less reticent in cracking down on the protesters than is Mubarak today.
Uh-huh. It would be poetic justice if in Iran there was an uprising.
Right. Well, I think there the Obama administration lost a very valuable opportunity to support the forces in Iran that were looking to overthrow the government last year. They were basically asleep at the wheel. And I see there's a lot of criticism of the American administration today from certain Israelis for turning their backs on Mubarak. I don't know if the criticism is justified. I'm not sure that America carries any real sway in these protests. In fact, to the extent that Mubarak is perceived as an American ally may harm his cause, not help it.
Mm-hmm.
So the days of every dictator are numbered. It's only a question of will they die in their sleep or will they be overthrown by someone else. But, you know, there is an uncanny resemblance to what's happening today in Egypt to what happened over three decades ago in Iran. Remember, Iran at the time was a secular, Western-leaning country that was linked to Israel and was run more or less by an autocrat, the Shah. And when the mob took to the streets, the mob, a coalition of various groups wanting different things, to Westerners, to the naive Westerners who they saw just as pleas for democracy. But in fact, there were different interests then as well. Some wanted bread, some wanted an end to the torture of the Shah's secret police, and some wanted a greater role for Islam in their lives. Well, those are the exact same forces that are in Egypt today. Some of the protesters just want bread, and tens of millions of Egyptians who subsist on $2 a day, and if there was a slight rise in the price of bread, such as happened a few weeks ago, well, they can't afford it, and they take to the streets. And other want an end to the torture of Mubarak's secret police, and others want a greater Islamization of Egyptian life. Unfortunately, again, the way these revolutions turn out, very often it's the most extreme element that is able to take power.
Rabbi, do you have anything hopeful at this moment?
Well, it's hard to be hopeful. Obviously, the effect on Israel is causing many anxious moments there. But there are two dangers I think it's important to point out, and maybe that should give us encouragement for the future if only we draw the appropriate lessons from this. Firstly, there's always an asymmetry in any negotiations between a democracy and a dictatorship. Israel signed a peace treaty with Egypt 31 years ago. That peace treaty has remained more or less stable. Granted, it's a cold peace, but there have been very few active hostilities emanating from Egypt to Israel. But a democracy can never back out of a treaty. It's unthinkable that even the most right-wing government, and you had, for example, in the 80s, Yitzhak Shamir became the prime minister. He had voted against the treaty with Egypt. But nonetheless, it was unthinkable that he should renounce the treaty when he took office. Well, with a dictatorship, you're not making a treaty with a government or a people. You're making a treaty with one person. And when that one person does not survive, then it does create many anxious moments. It's up to the will of the successor to determine whether he will continue to obey the terms of that treaty. So Mubarak did when Sadat was killed. But who's to say whoever takes power after Mubarak will be so inclined? Probably in the short term, they'll pay lip service to it. In the long term meaning a year or 2 years, who knows? Because the Muslim Brotherhood has vowed to renounce that treaty. The second danger, and this is where I think it has practical ramifications for Israel today, is Israel is always in the position of trading tangible assets for words on a document. You can't trade the tangible for the intangible, because what's given up is very hard to retrieve. What's gained in terms of promises or words is very easily lost. So think now, when Israel signed its peace treaty with Egypt, it gave up land, it gave up strategic depth, the Sinai Peninsula, and importantly, it gave up oil in the Abu Rodeis fields, as well as natural gas. Now, part of the treaty that Egypt committed to provide, to sell to Israel in perpetuity, that oil and natural gas. Well, who knows what the next government is going to do? So it couldn't turn out that after three decades, that treaty was for naught, and again, Israel had traded the tangible for the verbal. That should remind us that negotiations with a totalitarian entity, such as the Palestinian Authority, is also futile and also dangerous.
Of course.
Because again, you're involved in giving up land, tangible assets, in exchange for words and promises that even if Abbas was inclined to carry through, which I don't believe, but even if he was inclined to, who's to say whoever succeeds him will be so inclined?
Sure.
And therefore you're back in the same position that Israel might be in the next few months vis-a-vis Egypt.
Of course.
And there's a domino effect. You have all these autocracies in the Middle East, where they're really kleptocracies, where you have the few people in power enriching themselves at the expense of the people, and there's no real difference in that sense between Egypt and Tunisia on the one hand, and Algeria and Libya and really Jordan and Syria and other countries as well.
Sure.
So the trends are not good, but if Israel draws the appropriate conclusions and stops the madness of negotiating away its own land in the hopes of getting some nice ceremony and words on a paper that might disappear in a month or a year, then I think there'll be some positive lessons drawn from this turmoil as well. But in the short term, it will create some anxious moments for Israel.
Of course, Rabbi, when Yamit was uprooted, and I think of the brave people of Gush Katif who were uprooted, we saw that giving up land for what? Look what we got. Look what we got.
Right, and that was the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. That was the price that was paid.
Mm-hmm.
And Art, there's a certain benefit to it. Someone asked me the other day, was it a mistake? I personally believe that if you've won territory in a defensive war, you should keep it, and it's always a mistake to return it to the aggressor. But aside from that, Israel has had benefits from a relatively peaceful southern border, but it's always been on borrowed time. And now we see that stability, that apparent stability, may have been at the expense of great instability in the future.
Well, Rabbi, I'm sure you'll join us again for future comments, and I look forward to that. And thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us.
Be my pleasure. Take care.
Well, that was my friend Rabbi Stephen Przanski of Congregation B'nai Yeshurun in Teaneck, New Jersey. And he always hits the nail right on the head, and he will be back. I do have something that an interview that we had in 1995. I'm going to play it sometime in the next few weeks because it's scary. Nothing changes. Nothing changes, that's for sure. Okay, I hope that you have enjoyed this first hour of 2 Hours of Jewish Soul, and we'll get ready for the second hour of Chazanus.
This is